the third case for oral argument this morning is Glemcher Supermall Venture Appellant versus Coleman Company and Dwight Sobczak, appellees. For the appellant, I understand, Ms. Feifel, you'll be speaking this morning. All right. And for the appellees, Mr. Ted McBride.
Yes.
Very well. Ms. Feifel, you may proceed, and you have 20 minutes. Before you start, the court should know for the record that Justice Sabres has disqualified himself, and the court has appointed the Honorable Jean Paul Keane, recently retired judge from the Second Circuit, to sit in his place. You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Jane Feifel, along with Haven Stuck. It's our privilege to represent Glemcher Supermall Ventures today in this fraudulent transfer action. We are here asking you to reverse the decision of the trial court, which found there was no fraudulent transfer, either actually or constructively, and to reverse the finding that the defendant appellees were entitled to a defense of equitable and or promissory estoppel. These parties came together in 1994 when Glemcher's predecessor in interest was constructing a mall outside of Seattle, Washington. The Coleman Company, a local manufacturer in Rapid City of Black Hills Gold Jewelry that sells that jewelry nationwide and, well, actually worldwide, was interested in selling jewelry out on the West Coast. They found that they wanted to have a retail store in this new mall. So Coleman Company created Black Hills Gold Factory Outlet as a Washington corporation. It had the same, essentially the same shareholders, directors, and officers as Coleman Company, which is a closely held corporation. Dwight Sobczak was president of both Coleman Company and president of Black Hills Gold Factory Outlet. Coleman Company was going to take over all management, do all the financial affairs for the Black Hills Gold Factory Outlet store. Black Hills Gold then signed a lease as president. Dwight Sobczak signed the lease and for a 7-year lease with the mall. He then signed a 1-year guarantee for the first year's rent payments on behalf of Coleman Company. They started business in 1995 and proceeded to sell Black Hills Gold jewelry at this outlet store in the mall. In 2001, they decided that it wasn't successful. They wanted to end the business, and so they began taking steps to close down the business by wire transferring. There was approximately $56,000 in the account. Wire transferred $45,000 of that back to South Dakota, began shipping the inventory and equipment that it was there back to South Dakota, and then during this process of closing down, at some point, Glemcher sees that they're vacating the premises, writes to them and says, you're in breach of the lease because you're vacating early and you're also, you haven't paid your January rent. You need to cure these defaults and we'll take remedies against you. They do pay the January rent, but they close it down and there is no more rent forthcoming from Black Hills Gold to its landlord, Glemcher. So the Glemcher then, after doesn't receive any more rent, sues Black Hills Gold in Washington. Black Hills Gold agrees that they can take a judgment against them, $90,000 plus interest. And when they try and enforce that, of course, there's no assets left because they have all gone to South Dakota to Coleman Company. They follow, Black Hills Gold to South Dakota. They can't, there are no assets to recover because they rest in the hands of Coleman, so they bring this fraudulent transfer action.
I want to make sure I understand one thing, that the transfers occurred before the judgment, correct?
It occurred before the judgment, Your Honor, but when the obligation was due and owing under the lease.
Was it a month-to-month obligation or was it an annual payment?
They paid month-to-month, but it was an 84-month lease.
Following up on Justice Sinner's question, did the transfer occur before the suit was filed in Washington?
Yes, the transfer occurred before. And so they were on notice, Glemcher was on notice when the place starts to close down. They can see what's happening. Both South Dakota and Washington have adopted the Uniform Fraudulent Transfer Act. The parties agreed and the trial court found that Washington law applies in this case. The purpose of the Uniform Fraudulent Transfer Act is to thwart depletion of debtors' estates to the disadvantage of unsecured creditors. We contend that's precisely what happened here. Trial court found that there was no actual fraud, and under the statute, actual fraud is to hinder, delay, or defraud a creditor. We believe that that was clearly erroneous. Trial court found, took a look at some of the 11 factors, which are non-exclusive. They don't create a presumption, but they are indicia of fraud happening. The number one was insider. This transfer went to an insider. Court clearly found that. Court found, number five, that it was a transfer of all of the assets. Well, substantially is what the badge said, but it's all of the assets. And the court found that the debtor was insolvent. The court clearly found three. Then the court talked about the whether the transfer was disclosed or concealed. The court said not concealed, but it clearly wasn't disclosed. The court ruled that the debtor did remove assets, badge of fraud number seven, but didn't conceal them. So it's a little, we get some and some is taken away there. Then, number 10, the transfer occurred shortly before, shortly after the substantial debt was incurred. In our view, the minute they breached the lease, the remainder of the lease payments came due. And so they, judge says in a memorandum opinion, that happened. But in the findings of fact, he backed away from that and said, well, it wasn't clear really whether the lease payments were due. But he clearly said they were due.
Was there an acceleration clause in the lease?
I'm sorry?
Was there an equivalent of an acceleration clause in the lease where if you're in default, they could declare the rest of it due and owing immediately?
Your Honor, I'm not exactly sure. But as I understand, that's the way they were interpreting it. And that's the way the parties agreed that the judgment would be when they entered into it. What the court didn't rule on was absconding, badge of fraud six. The debtor clearly took the assets out of the state, followed the assets out of the state, and this corporation was dissolved in 2001 administratively by the state of Washington. Then the court found that there's no lawsuit pending, badge of fraud four. But clearly the threat of lawsuit had been raised by that letter that was sent by Glimcher's lawyer to Black Hills Gold saying you're in default here.
Was that letter sent before they removed the assets?
Well, we don't know precisely, but they can see what's happening, and they know they haven't been paid. And
all
so
right.
The two come together. So,
in close proximity, I would take it then, in time.
Yes, in January. This all happened quite early in January. That letter happens to be dated January 15th. So, we believe that the court clearly erred when it had all these badges of fraud. But what the court looked to specifically, the court said that reasonably equivalent value was exchanged here. And reasonably equivalent value becomes intertwined in all of this fraudulent transfer issues. It becomes a badge of fraud, in actual fraud, but it becomes one of the elements in constructive fraud. And the court, in our view, erred when it found reasonably equivalent value was exchanged in this transaction.
On that point, let me ask a question right up front, because it didn't appear to me that anyone contested the fact that the debt was $600,000 or whatever, and the resale value of this inventory was $213,000, and there was a little more cash. So how do you get around the fact, that doesn't appear to be disputed, that they clearly got a lot more debt resolved than the value of the assets transferred?
That's correct, Your Honor, but they were an insider. They had complete control over this debtor. And so they're the ones that determine the timing. They're the ones that determine when they're going to make the transfer. They go in and they scoop out absolutely all of the assets, and they pay off a few creditors, but specifically leave this creditor out. And when we look at both all the factors surrounding reasonably equivalent value and all the factors surrounding actual fraud, we clearly see that this was not a situation that was it's simply fraud transpired here. The entire business was gone. If this were a reasonably equivalent transfer, the business would have stayed operational. But there was simply nothing left for the business.
What really happened here is one unsecured creditor got preferential treatment to another.
Well,
unless we're going to look behind the corporate fiction of Coleman being a corporation, They're both unsecured creditors. One got favored over the other. Maybe the preference issue should be decided in bankruptcy, but I don't know that the fact one unsecured creditor gets in ahead of another necessarily violates the Uniform Fraud Act.
Well, I'd agree with you, Your Honor, if Coleman wasn't also an insider. But it wasn't as if Coleman were this other entity who had no interest in the proceedings. Coleman came in and, to the detriment of all the unsecured creditors, makes a decision of what's going to happen. This wasn't the debtor saying, you know, I prefer to pay Landstrom's over Coleman. This was the creditor calling all of the shots. And so clearly they were not, they secured themselves in an incredible way by their behavior. And this is what precisely the type of case that the Uniform Fraudulent Transfer Act is designed to prevent.
Does it weaken your case, the fact that $600,000 to Coleman was due and owing for some time when they vacated, yet they were current with you people? But for the lease, they paid you every dime you had coming. You're trying to get rent for future vacancies, not past occupation.
Well, they entered into a contract. Black Hills Gold entered into a contract, and we can presume they got some favorable rate for taking a 7-year contract. You know, it isn't up to us to decide whether that was a good business decision or not. But we set the property aside for 84 months, and they said, we agree, we're going to rent it for this entire time. So we pursue our remedies at the appropriate place against Black Hills Gold. And we can't go get the money due us because of the actions of Coleman, that they go in and they take all of the assets, completely deplete the debtor in this case. It wasn't an arm's-length transaction. And we can say, did we get paid? Yeah, we got paid exactly what we bargained for, but we didn't up to that day, but we didn't get paid the rest of what we bargained for, and we're entitled to go collect that. We aren't collecting, but we'd have no reason to bring this action against Coleman if they hadn't taken all the assets. If they had left the assets with the debtor where we could go get our remedy against the debtor, there would be no reason to bring this action. But it was their actions that brought this on.
If they had not had enough assets to satisfy what you had coming, then could you still go on after Coleman for the balance under your theory?
No, there wouldn't have been a fraudulent transfer at that point. We're going after them solely because of their improper actions in transferring those assets out of the debtor. I think, to finish up with actual fraud, that the entire business was gone here. And they specifically chose, knowing Sobchak testified at the court trial, that he knew there were 19 months remaining on that lease. And they specifically chose not to pay Glimcher when they had plenty of money available to pay him. The directors and the officers of the corporation here didn't take into the interest all of the creditors. They had complete financial control, and unlike most cases, they were making the decision. The transferee, Coleman Company, made the decision where the assets went. When we look to constructive fraud, the trial court found no actual fraud, but also no constructive fraud. At this point, actual intent doesn't come into it. But where the court went so wrong, in our view, is the court looked at it from the perspective of Coleman and said, golly, you sent all this jewelry out, $600,000 worth, and you're only going to get $200,000. Gee, that doesn't really seem fair. Well, that's not what the question is. The question is, stand in the shoes of Glimcher and look at the transaction. All of the assets leave Black Hills Gold and go to Coleman. Nothing comes back to Black Hills Gold.
But shouldn't reasonably equivalent value be determined from the perspective of Coleman as opposed to your client?
That isn't what the courts say. If you look at that Badger State Bank case versus Taylor.
Some say the opposite.
Well, they say, I haven't found a case where they look at it from the perspective of the transferee, but instead where they look at it from the perspective of the creditor.
What about the debtor?
Well, they're looking at the creditor is looking at the debtor and saying, what do you have left that I could satisfy my obligation from? And if there's something left for the debtor to satisfy the obligation, for example, if it had stayed in business, was able to continue to earn money, then reasonably equivalent value has been exchanged.
Well, the problem I see is that you focus on no benefit to to Glimcher, but the act says a creditor, not the creditor, and I don't understand why we should focus simply on your client's viewpoint. Why not any unsecured creditor? It seems to me the act intended that it should be looked at from all unsecured creditors, and if any one of them is receiving a benefit, then it doesn't qualify under Section 3 of the Act.
I agree with you. That's what the Act says. But the way I read the cases is that the courts say, let's look at the creditor who's complaining, the creditor who got out of the deal, that's the one we're going to look at, what is left.
But if we do that, aren't we essentially then creating a preference dispute that's usually resolved in bankruptcy? Because now we're pitting one unsecured creditor against another.
No one's complaining here. Glimcher's the only one that's complaining.
But if we adopt the rule that your client, we got to look at this solely through your client's view, that's going to say in the next case that any unsecured creditor who doesn't get paid and another unsecured creditor does, you got to look at it solely through the eyes of a particular unsecured creditor that was favored.
You know, in this case of Belt versus Wachovia, I think this is the issue you're talking about. The court there said this debtor had debts with all these banks, chose Wachovia to pay. And so Belt comes in and says, hey, wait a minute, this wasn't fair. I had an antecedent debt too, and you chose to pay him. And the court said, no, the debtor can choose who to pay. What the debtor cannot do is be controlled by the one who got paid. Can't be controlled by an insider. And the Seventh Circuit said it's a completely different situation when an insider's getting paid or when a related corporate entity is getting paid. And that's the problem. That reasonably equivalent value could happen and other creditors could absolutely get shut out. And the courts have looked at that over and over and said it's okay. Where it's not okay is in this case where you have an insider taking advantage of their position.
Under the Act, then, if your argument prevails, what happens to the $250,000 or whatever it's worth? Do you split it? Do you get all of it? Is it pro rata or what?
We get our judgment, $90,000 plus our interest. The amount of the wrongful transfer comes back.
What if there had been other unsecured creditors?
Well,
would you get your judgment for other unsecured creditors? Because this case is going to apply to others in the future. In this case, there only happened to be two at the end. But what if there were six? Would you get your entire judgment and the other three or four who are not related not get anything?
And presuming they didn't bring an action?
Right.
Well, I presume if they didn't bring an action that under this statute they would not recover. The courts clearly say that we need to look at what did the debtor receive in exchange for what it gave up. And we look at that from the perspective of the creditor. And we say, debtor, what do you have left that we could attach to get our to fulfill our obligation? And the courts that have looked at this have said, if, for example, the debtor does the payment strengthened the debtor ultimately. The debtor was able to stay in business. The debtor was able to preserve or protect its property. Or it could restructure and continue maybe the parent could restructure and continue providing funds. That would be reasonably equivalent value. But it is not reasonably equivalent value where the transferee is an officer, a director, a major shareholder, where they have financial control over the debtor. Because clearly the debtor didn't make the choice here. Briefly, I want to address the estoppel argument. The court did find that they were entitled to a defense of estoppel. Our position is that is only available had we sued them directly under the lease. We didn't do that. We sued who we were supposed to sue, the person we made the lease with, the entity, Black Hills Gold. And it was the only reason we ended up suing Coleman was because of their wrongful actions. It's unfair for them to clothe themselves now with the guarantee and say, oh, you can't pursue anything against us. There's not one word in the guarantee that would lead one to believe that they could proceed, make fraudulent transfers, be a party to fraudulent transfers, and then claim protection by that guarantee. We think that was a red herring for the court, that it obfuscated the issues, and that the court improperly accepted that argument. We believe that this case exemplifies why the Fraudulent Transfer Act exists, that this all property and assets of an insolvent debtor were transferred to an out-of-state insider who controlled the debtor when substantial debt was incurred, suit was threatened, and that the transfer effectively ended the business of the debtor. It had no direct, immediate benefit for any other creditor, and because there was no reasonably equivalent value exchanged, the creditors were not able to pursue their remedies against the debtor. And that's the only thing we wanted to do, was be able to pursue our remedies against the debtor. And it was the actions of Coleman Company and Sobchak that deprived us of our ability to pursue our remedies.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. McBride, you have 20 minutes, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Ted McBride, and I represent Coleman and Dwight Sobchak. And I'm not sure I'm pronouncing his name right. I always get it wrong. It was said here this morning that this case exemplifies the Fraudulent Transfer Act. Actually, not one case has been cited where, under circumstances such as these, someone was held liable under the Uniform Fraudulent Transfer Act under Sections 4. Section 5B is a little different, and I'm going to talk about that. That's kind of the elephant in the corner that hasn't been talked about here. But first, I want to go just a little onto what the trial court found, as it relates to estoppel. There was testimony, it was unrefuted by Dwight Sobchak, and his affidavit was admitted with the only objection to it being relevancy. Mr. Stock twice said he had no objections to its foundation. That's been raised now in the briefs as hearsay, but that issue was waived. Any hearsay problem could have been corrected right on the spot. Mr. Sobchak was in the courtroom. He testified. Mr. Von Wald, who tried the case, could have obviated that problem. The trial court could have been made aware of it. Simply weren't. They were told by Mr. Stuck on behalf of Glimshire that the only objection was, we don't think any of this testimony applies or is relevant because estoppel isn't relevant. Well, the statute itself indicates that estoppel is not affected. No cases have been decided for this proposition that it somehow doesn't apply in a situation like this. Coleman Company, as the testimony went, entered into a deal with the predecessor of Glimshire Mall after negotiations. The mall wanted Coleman there. Coleman was a little worried. They didn't know anything about these people. It was a new mall. They didn't know if they were going to get their anchors. Glimshire refused to put a provision in the lease that would allow Coleman to get out if the anchors didn't come, which is what happened in the Elliott Bay case that I think has been cited by the plaintiffs.
Mr. McBride, though, didn't all those issues essentially get merged into the judgment? I mean, those were all defenses that would, and issues that should have been raised in the breach of lease case. And once they agreed, once both sides agreed to a judgment, it seems to me that whether they did this and whether they did that, it's all, should all be merged into that judgment.
Well, Your Honor, in fact, Coleman was not a party to that case. It would have been no defense for Black Hills Gold. In effect, what happened here is Coleman and the mall looked at the risks, and they ended up with a fair balance, what they decided would be a fair balance of risks. The risk would be that Coleman would guarantee for 1 year, and that Glimshire would accept that as Coleman's entire liability.
Is that written? Where is that? I know about the guarantee, but I don't see anything where there's a limit of liability. Where's that?
The limit of liability is in that guarantee. It says, Your Honor, one, that it will extend no further than 1 year.
But that's the guarantee will extend
right,
no
that's,
more than
and
1 year.
That's Coleman's liability under the lease. That was the trade-off that they reached.
That seems like what the trial court did was it took the guarantee and turned it into a limit of liability, but the guarantee just says this is the amount that we're going to guarantee. It doesn't say this is the amount that we won't be liable for.
Well, that's where the estoppel and the comes in, Your Honor, and the testimony from Mr. Sobchak, which was not challenged at all in terms of any other testimony. And this was what Mr. Sobchak was operating under. He then he started supplying Black Hills Gold Outlet with product, Coleman did, to the point where it's been noted it was $600,000 in debt.
Why didn't he stop supplying? I mean, when you see the ship sinking, why do you keep throwing ballast into the ship?
His testimony was that he was getting assurances from the mall that things were going to turn around, they were going to land better, and he was trying to make it work.
But he's a businessman. He's got a separate corporation. His guarantee was up after 1 year. He had no further liability. He could have just let Black Hills Gold sink in the state of Washington and walked away.
You're right. He could have.
And so when he didn't do that, and he kept pumping money into Black Hills Gold, why should we bail the ship out for him?
Well, at the same time, he's paying Glimcher. He ended up paying Glimcher $250,000 they never would have had if he hadn't pumped money.
Directly or through Black Hills Gold?
Through Black Hills Gold.
Okay, so he didn't do it directly?
No.
Okay, so I think we ought to get that off the deck.
Well, it was Coleman who subsidized Black Hills Gold, in effect, subsidizing.
But that's a business. You've got two separate corporations, one in Washington, one in South Dakota. One wants to keep the ship floating. It's a business decision made. It was a bad business decision. The business in Washington was going under, and then the business in Washington eventually ended up in a judgment posture in Washington. And now we're here to bail Coleman out because of a bad business decision.
Well, Your Honor, I respectfully disagree, and I think the trial court was the one who actually had the ability to see the witness and judge the credibility of the witness. And if there is if there's evidence to support that decision, then this court should support that decision.
What about the comment that Judge Tice made in his decision where he talked about Coleman's good faith?
Well, there was good faith, Your Honor. That's where this case, I have not seen, and I have not seen cited, a case where a creditor gave so much and then got pursued outside of Section 5 of the Uniform Fraudulent Transfer Act. Without the estoppel, let us be clear, this case, this payment from, or the transfer of the inventory from Black Hills Gold to Coleman under Section 5 of the Uniform Transfer Act would have been set aside. Absent the estoppel. It is a transfer of an antecedent debt to an insider. That is the end of the story under that statute. We aren't here under that statute. There is a statute of repose of 1 year under that statute. It is extinguished. And all of these cases we're talking about, what we really need to come back to is, frankly, a South Dakota case, Prairie Lakes Healthcare Systems versus Wookiee, because it probably, and as I was reading it again, I realized it laid out the distinction about as well as you could lay it out of what went on here.
I thought we were deciding this under Washington law.
We are, Your Honor, but the Uniform Fraudulent Transfer Act has a provision in it that says it is to be construed consistent with other states as near as possible to keep it a uniform act.
Is there an equivalent Washington case? I think there is.
I don't think there is, Your Honor. Not equivalent. The Clearwater case is not equivalent. That's one where they found there wasn't reasonably equivalent value because the president of a corporation had signed a note personally, and as president of the corporation, and a house had been put that she thought she was buying was ended up put in the corporation's name. Then she transferred it back. And the court there found, and it's not a very well-written opinion, it's pretty confusing to follow, but ultimately what they found is that there you had to look at it from the benefit of the creditor, and that no one got a benefit. Her creditor may have gotten a benefit. The president's creditor may have gotten a benefit, but there was nothing that benefited a creditor in that case because the creditor already had the house on it. It was a trust deed, it was called, I think, or mortgage, and already had her on the note, the president. So it did the creditor no good, the bank, and it was voided. I would like to go back to Wookiee because we are trying to construe these statutes uniformly, and it explains the overall statute. And what Justice Konenkamp did is he started out looking at each one of the three sections where the phrase reasonably equivalent value appears. You look at it where all the badges of fraud are, you then look at it in 4B, and then you look at it in 5. Now, in the first part of that case, or the first finding under 4A, let's see, it's 4A1, where you look at the badges of fraud, nearly every badge of fraud was present. But the court held that although an inference of fraudulent intent can be drawn, it doesn't provide for a shifting of the burden. And reasonably equivalent value was viewed there. One of the things that was viewed was monies that had been paid by the son of the debtor to the parents to help them out. And this court said whether the transfers are reasonably equivalent value in every case is largely a question of fact to which considerable latitude must be allowed to the trier of fact. The trial court in that case found that those debts that the son had paid for the parents was reasonably equivalent value, upheld the trial court on the finding that there was no actual fraud. Now, the transfer was set aside. Why? Because of 5B. 5B is not available here. What the plaintiff is attempting to do is to conflate all of these statutes by saying insider, 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 over and over. In point of fact, as this court noted in Wookiee, UFTA is novel in the sense that it does away with preferential transfers under certain circumstances. Also noted in that case that some states haven't adopted it simply because it favors one unsecured creditor over the other, and there wasn't a feeling that was right. Well, our legislature decided to adopt it, but the trade-off was that 1 year statute of limitations. It's really a statute of repose. But it's there, it's cut off. It's not, it doesn't come back. When you look at the issue of actual fraud, as Judge Tice viewed it in this case, the first element, insider, was there. It's an insider.
Can the insider factor be considered under the constructive fraud provision?
And I think that's 4A2. It's
not written in there.
Now the real issue is reasonably equivalent value, Your Honor.
So can insider be considered a factor there?
I think it only comes into play in terms of credibility and viewing whether an antecedent debt is reasonably equivalent value. I don't think it becomes. It certainly doesn't become the tripwire it is in 5, because it is. That's a tripwire in 5. But since 5 doesn't apply, we actually have to look at the other two statutes and can't just keep using the incantation, the insider. They were an insider. The next is whether the debtor retained control of the property. That didn't happen here. The debtor is expired. Whether the transfer was disclosed or concealed, it wasn't concealed. It took place during daylight. It took place with the security guards, as the testimony was there, in the mall. It wasn't concealed in any fashion.
Was it disclosed?
What?
It wasn't disclosed, though.
It wasn't concealed. It was the mall's the space was empty. There wasn't anything put up to hide the fact that it was empty or anything.
There's a distinction here. One talks about disclosed, one talks about concealed, and they're in the alternative. So, I mean, did Black Hills Gold or Coleman go tell Glimcher that, hey, we're leaving?
I don't believe there's any record of that, Your Honor.
Is Coleman's good faith, again, I never quite got into this, is Coleman's good faith relevant in this matter?
Coleman's good faith is relevant to the finding of actual fraud, Your Honor. You can, because under 4A1, you have to find actual fraud. You have to find an intent. So their good faith is crucial. And that's, again, a finding of fact. I mean, if they wanted to stiff people, they could have started filing security interests on the inventory they were putting in. And there would have been absolutely nothing anyone could have done. They could have not paid the light bill. They could have not waited 6 months and not paid Glimcher. They paid every current debt they had. They had a contingent, unliquidated debt to Glimcher. No one knew, whether Glimcher was going to rent that next week or rent it 5 years from then. So they paid everyone up to the end.
Well, you keep saying they.
They, Coleman, it was a corporation.
But you just told me a while ago, Coleman wasn't making the payments. Black Hills Gold made the payments.
Black Hills Gold made the payments. The money was from Coleman. In terms of the money was advanced and in inventory. Someone pointed out, there was never any question about the debt owed by Black Hills Gold to Coleman, whether it was actually incurred. It was undisputed, and it was over $600,000. So, in terms of that factor on the reasonably equivalent, and Justice Zinter hit the nail on the head when he, and I believe the first argument this morning was hinging on A and the in some way, whether it's in this one, the statute says a creditor, and the argument that's being made is it can only be the one creditor. If that's the case, whoever gets to the courthouse first always wins. Because if the creditor only means the one that comes and sued, when you look at reasonably equivalent value, you may as well write that part of the statute out of existence. It will no longer have a meaning. At least the part where, I think it's in 3, where reasonably equivalent value can mean an antecedent debt. There's a complex setup that's been established by this act to deal with unsecured debtors. And preferential treatment is allowed under some circumstances. In this case, it's allowable except for 5. The case wasn't brought under 5. We have, while we aren't supposed to count the number of badges to decide who wins, although I guess they do that in some jurisdictions. They don't do it in Washington. We don't do it in South Dakota. When you look at those, as the trial court did, and unless the trial court was clearly erroneous, then I submit you have to affirm this judgment in all respects. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. McBride. Ms. Feifel, you have 10 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. Yeah. I think it comes from the Department of Unintended Irony that we are accused of wanting to go under this Section 5B. That'd be like shooting fish in the barrel in this case. I would love that, but we are past that. We don't have that opportunity. But what we do have is we still have actual fraud available to us, and we still have constructive fraud under Washington Law 19.041A2. This transfer was made, it was fraudulent to a creditor, whether the claim arose before or after the transfer was made, if the debtor that made the transfer didn't receive reasonably equivalent value in exchange for it, and the debtor would incur debts beyond his ability to pay the remainder of the lease. That's precisely what happened here. In 051A, that statute set as also, it's not B, the one-year deal, I understand that, it says the transfer is made or the obligation is incurred is fraudulent to the debtor whose claim arose before the transfer was made, if it was made without reasonably equivalent value, and the debtor was insolvent. It's exactly what happened here. We're not asking for more than the statute. Would I like to have 5B? Absolutely. We're not asking for that. And I think what's most interesting here is when appellees confuse who paid the bills here. That's exactly what went wrong. The confusion of who was the debtor. The debtor was Black Hills Gold. They entered into a lease. They didn't make their payments. Coleman Company begins to treat the debtor. They begin to treat the debtor as if all the assets are theirs. Mr. Sobchak testified he sold those assets to Black Hills Gold. And so now he comes in and says, well, let's see, how about there's $200,000 left? I take it. I don't get this claim that he engaged in extreme good faith. That just baffles me, how the court could get to that decision when he said, I know, at pages 18 and 19, that there were 19 months remaining on the lease. We knew that existed. Instead, he makes a decision that he will prefer his own business over the other creditors that exist. He says, well, gee, we paid the employees. Well, of course you pay the employees, because if you don't, you have future liability that attaches, both criminal and civil. You pay your taxes, because if you don't, the debtor's going to have future liabilities. The one they thought they could escape out of was by not paying the landlord. And to say, well, we were up to date, that completely defeats what the lease says. And he agreed that he would obligate himself for 1 year, and that's it. That guarantee becomes nothing more than that. And to suggest that somehow they were subsidizing and they had this idea of what was going to happen. He's a very experienced businessman. Businesses all over the country. He knew exactly what he was doing here, and he chose to back out. And it isn't fair to creditors that put themselves out there. We can't rely on credit transactions if we're going to allow insiders to come in and take advantage of their specialized knowledge. The claim that this is not like any other case, it is like Clearwater. And I agree Clearwater's difficult to understand. Clearwater's wanted Skyline Construction to build them a house. They didn't like how it went, and they were going to sue them. Prior to that, Panasuk, the president of Skyline, had purchased property. She put it in the name of Skyline, and she borrowed money and put it in the name of Skyline. Later, when the arbitration starts to proceed, she then has the property transferred into her name personally, saying, oh, really? I intended to be for me. And she paid off part of the bank loan. So she says reasonably equivalent value was exchanged. I paid, and I got this deed. The court said, no, that's not reasonably equivalent value, because look at Clearwaters. What can they get against Skyline if you take the property away? The bank benefited, certainly. That creditor benefited. But Clearwaters did not benefit by that transaction. Badger State Bank versus Taylor's. Ron Vogt owns AgWest, and he has an interest in A&T Livestock. AgWest owes money to Taylor's. The Taylor's owe money to A&T. Vogt, who's an insider, both of those, goes to Taylor's and says, how about we just cancel those loans and each of us pay, or I'll pay you about $2,500 more. The bank comes and says, wait a minute. AgTech has lost its accounts receivable. You need to bring those back. Taylors stand and say, wait, it was reasonably equivalent for us. We got rid of our debt. We're fine. We owed and we paid, so everything's fine. That was reasonably equivalent. Badger State Bank says, not for us. When you look at our debtor, that was not fair. The assets are not there for us. That's what happened here. The assets weren't there for us to levy against. We should have been able to attach those assets, but Coleman treats them as if they're their own, and that's what's wrong here. They use their specialized position, and it cannot be reasonably equivalent value under those circumstances.
Can the insider factor be considered under the constructive fraud provision?
Yes.
What language? Point me to the language here.
Well, reasonably equivalent value isn't defined in the code.
No, insider. Can insider be a factor, a badge, so to speak, under a constructive fraud?
I understand the question, and I didn't answer it very well. What I'm saying is because the code doesn't define reasonably equivalent value, the courts have said you can look at more than simply $600,000 owed, $200,000 received, that you are entitled to look at the other circumstances around that. And that's where these factors, and there's, I can't remember exactly the page number cited in my brief, but where those cases come in where they say, it is reasonably equivalent value because the debtor was able to stay in business, because the debtor could protected its property. And so we are going to allow that to happen. But courts have specifically said, not where it's to a payments to an insider. We are going to say that is not reasonably equivalent value. And who the people who get protected under the law are the unsecured creditors. And this statute certainly has gone back. I was interested to learn way back to the Magna Carta that we have protected creditors for a long time for good reason. And if Mr. McBride is right, they could have gotten a security interest, then they should have. They should have protected themselves by a legal method. And then we could have been put on notice what was going to happen. But it isn't fair to take a better remedy than what the law allows. They put themselves in a position to get more than they were entitled to under the law. We believe that this case is exactly what the law was designed to prevent, that insiders cannot use their specialized position to transfer assets out of a debtor to themselves at a time when the debtor's insolvent and when they don't give anything back to the debtor. The $200,000 left the debtor, and what was Black Hills Gold left with? Nothing. Couldn't continue in business anymore. That is not a reasonably equivalent value. There was actual fraud in this case by the all of those badges of fraud. When the court, when you clearly examine each one, 9 of those 11 are in the court, are, if we were going to draw a column, are in the column of Black Hills Gold. There was no, this transfer was fraudulent from beginning to end. This transfer was fraudulent constructively. If you find that, well, gee, we don't really think that there was intent, that that isn't what they intended to do, we still prevail because of the lack of reasonably equivalent value. When Glimcher looks at what happened to this transaction, they came out on the short end of the stick. The debtor had nothing in which Glimcher could attach. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We'll be in recess until tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock.